Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Black Excellence. Now, I'm your Professor Shaw. I'm also with
Professor HBK.
And Professor William. Remain seated and enjoy the show.
Oh, yeah. He's there
for the pleasure of me, so.
Remain seated and enjoy the show. But yeah, y'all ready? So I came in on a little wait. I'll say that.
All right, so let me hold up. Let me tell you what the show gonna be about. You feel me? Okay. So today we're gonna be talking about the positives of after slavery and stuff, because we talked about times during slavery, times before slavery, in the mix and stuff like that. So I think we did talk a little bit after, but we didn't talk about the positives. We talked about like other stuff. So today's show gonna be about stuff like that.
A little bit about some of the Reconstruction era and some of the things going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we're gonna be asking some questions and getting a little bit deeper into it. So let's go.
We on our social studies timing. You know the vibe.
Social studies.
Most of us know our country fought a civil war in the 1860s, but less is known about what came afterward, the chaotic, exhilarating, and ultimately devastating period known as Reconstruction. It was a moment of profound change with promises of citizenship and equal rights for all. One of the greatest achievements of Reconstruction was granting black men the right to vote. In 1867 alone, over 80% of all the black men in the former Confederate states registered to vote. 3 years later, Hiram Revels was elected the first black man to serve in the United States Senate, and Joseph Rainey became the first black United States congressman. Their election paved the way for more than 2,000 black office holders who served at every level of government during Reconstruction.
There are not many moments in recorded human history where a group that was so subordinated would, within the space of a decade, actually be integrated into the highest echelons of political society.
But the momentum wouldn't last. Black men's access to the ballot box, along with other key rights gained during Reconstruction, were rolled back systematically throughout the South.
In 1875, near the end of Reconstruction, the 44th Congress included 7 black House members and a United States Senator. By 1900, only one remained, Congressman George Henry White of North Carolina.
By the time George H. White leaves office in 1901, he literally turns the light off on national black political leadership. No one will come behind him for an entire generation.
One of the cruel ironies of Reconstruction is that black people could claim certain rights in the 1870s that they would have to fight to reclaim in the 1960s.
A sobering reminder that achievements thought permanent can be overturned and rights can never be taken for granted.
Want a lawn that looks like this, but your lawn looks...
Hello. Hi. Welcome.
Come on, it's nice.
So, y'all listened to that video. So, what's some of the stuff you guys pulled away from that?
Hold on.
Not for.
I had to set up real quick. Okay. So, what are some things you learned about it? And what are some things? Okay. So, what I like to do after, like, we watch a video, I like to go back and, like, listen to things, mm-hmm. as I usually do. So. Okay. Sorry, you're saying pretty good.
Is so subordinated, would, within the space of a decade, actually be integrated into the highest echelons of political society.
But the momentum wouldn't last. Black men's access to the ballot box,
along with other key rights gained during Reconstruction, were rolled back systematically throughout the South.
In 1875, near the end of Reconstruction, the 44th Congress included 7 black House members and a United States Senator. By 1900, only one remained, Congressman George Henry White of North Carolina.
By the time George H. White leaves office in 1901, he literally turns the light off on national black political leadership. No one will come behind him for an entire generation.
One of the cruel ironies of Reconstruction is that black people could claim certain rights in the 1870s that they would have to fight to reclaim in the 1960s.
A sobering reminder that achievements thought permanent can be overturned and rights can never be taken for granted.
Okay. So, something I learned so far is that he said in the 1970s they were able to get certain land, but
what land was it?
Just land, like, okay.
Was
so he's
a certain area.
Just like a certain area of land in general.
So, and then in the 1870s they were able to get certain land, but then said in 1960s they had to do it again. Yeah, they had to do it all over again just to get it.
So kind of fight to reclaim that
land.
Yeah,
they had to basically start over.
Okay.
What did you learn about the video?
So, you know what I'm saying? Basically just pulled that same thing. Okay. Talking about some of the land and things like that. Where?
Mm-hmm.
Where? This man right here, bro.
So, Lincoln, what about you?
The same thing.
Okay. So, I got a question. This was about voting, by the way. So, let's say y'all was voting back then, right? Y'all was around there.
Oh, yeah,
so
fact. Hold on.
Bro, you just interrupted my whole question.
Your question, I got the answer.
That was so disrespectful.
He's got his answer. He's getting his answer.
Goofy, I didn't get to finish my question.
I already knew what you were going to ask.
But you ain't let me finish. Like,
nope.
They didn't know what I was going to ask. They don't know what I was going to ask.
Never mind. I don't got my paper.
Thank you. So like I was saying, if you was voting back then, right, you was on that time, and someone, let's say, oh, by the way, trigger warning. If someone like KKK pulled up to you, right, you voting. They say, you vote for this person or your man's getting hung.
See, my man's going to have to go.
What?
No. Look. Look at my perspective, look. Hear me out. It depends. If who the homie is. And who the other person who I'm voting for is. Like, if it's Donald Trump or Marcelo Obama, then, respectfully, my homie gonna have to suffer.
What?
He would do the same thing.
That's wild.
Hold on. But hear me out. If it's, like, my blood brother, like, my brother,
boy.
Then... All right, I got you. But if it's just a dude that I knew for like 3 months, that
okay,
I was
that's
cool
different.
With,
that's different.
Nah, you dying.
If that's just a school friend,
exactly.
A
exactly.
Word, that's an acquaintance.
That's
he
different.
Can go,
yeah, you're my
but
acquainted.
If like that's like your brother since like preschool, then
right,
nah.
That's like
nah,
my day one. Like,
can't let him go.
I'm saying if that's your school friend that you be hanging out with once a year, then I really don't see why you're gonna
sorry.
Save him. Yeah, you could.
Nah, he can go.
What about you?
Me. So what I would do is I try to assess the situation as best as I can. Basically, just vote for whoever the KKK don't want to, because I'm not trying to die, or I'm not trying to let my brothers die, because we lost too many people. So with that being said, I'm just gonna try.
Hold
to
up,
do my
you didn't
best.
Specify. Are they white? Is your brother white? Like if he white, then
what?
They aren't even.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Why would
like,
they?
Like, no,
why,
no, no,
why,
no,
why would they hang a white person?
Why would they go after him?
But you have to specify that though. What if I only got white friends? Now what?
No,
that would
no.
That would
not
happen.
No, your friend is not white.
All right, so
like,
yeah, no.
Your friend is black.
Yeah. Same before.
So,
how about you? What's up, DJ Phoebe?
Hello,
yes. I mean, Professor Phoebe.
Yeah. Can I ask y'all a question?
Okay.
Go ahead.
I mean, what does it bring up for you that you, the fact that you're even having this conversation is tragic, right? Because
yeah.
this is the sort of thing that has anybody who's been oppressed has been confronted with, right? Is that they know that they actually assert their power. In this case, we're talking about voting, which is power, right? Because, like, who makes the decisions about who has money, who gets land, who has rights, right? The elected officials.
Yeah.
So you got to run for office and show up for those elections in order to fight for your people and your freedom. But to your point, a lot of times that then gets met with violence, right? And I think that's, you know, that those choices, like, are almost inevitable, and, like, that when you show up and you fight for your power, that there might be some violence that happens in response to that. And I don't think it's ever a choice of, like, all right, either you vote for this, or this person's going to get, you know, that you know is going to be targeted. But what will happen is, and there's a video, actually, I think the next one y'all are going to get into, that talks specifically about what that kind of intimidation at the polls really looks like. And, you know, basically that violence shows up when people assert their power. And you shouldn't have to choose between those things ever, right? I think I'm curious for all of you, too, just were you surprised to hear that there was way more Black people in positions of political power in 1870 than there were in 1960? Like, is that a surprise to you?
Is it a surprise? No.
Is it a surprise?
No. Yeah, like, would you have imagined that there was as more political power for Black people in 1870 than there was in 1960, 100 years later?
Actually, yeah, because I feel like some people never would, like, really know, like, back in the day, if they were, like, alive back then, they wouldn't know if they really get the type of rights we have, like, now, you know, back then.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, you know, I think a lot of times history is kind of shown as it's, like, always progressing, right? But actually, history tends to have bursts of progress, and then it slides backwards. And then a burst of progress, and then it can slide backwards. So in the first video you watch, when, you know, the end, Henry Louis Gates gives this warning, like, don't take your rights for granted, right? That you have to always defend them. And today, you know, we still are seeing lots of laws show up on the books that are trying to make it harder for Black people to vote. That's been a big fight in Georgia for the last year. So that's still going on today. But I know I was surprised to learn that history, to hear that, like, actually we almost realized a dream of having better race relationships and, like, having Black people in power in this country, right? That, like hundred there was hundreds and hundreds of Black people who were winning okay. elected official winning positions, right? It's like the vote was given, but then when Black people actually used the vote to get, you know, to have influence and to have power, that's when white people started to get kind of freaked out. And I believe, Professor William, you had brought up, you know, Jim Crow, for example, right? It was one of those backlashes that happened, right, as a result of that. But, you know, focusing on the positive, you know, how incredible is it that people who were formerly enslaved, within 10 years of that freedom, were elected to the most powerful positions in the country?
Right. It's crazy. It's like something that would definitely you don't expect to happen.
Yeah.
Right, and I think that caught white people off guard. They were convinced themselves that, like, Black people are ignorant, they won't have real power, and that was proven very, very wrong.
My question is, what always made white people say Black people was ignorant? Like,
colors.
Like, I know that, but I mean, like, that's crazy, because if you think about it, Black people really made a lot of stuff.
White people.
But I mean, like, think of it.
White people made the first actual child from another parent. What do you mean? If you think about it, Adam and Eve, right? They're both white, right? Feel me? So
but that's me. Not... I don't think that's actually true.
But
I don't think that's actually
people
true.
People of every color had babies, right? Like, that's not unique. White people did not birth civilization. That's not true.
I don't think that one's true. But...
You know, I think you can believe in Adam and Eve, but still not, you know, assume that they're white. It's like, you know, people used to believe that, you know, that a lot of, you know, historical figures have been taught to us as being white, right? Because that's how you keep white supremacy intact, right? Is to tell a story that it's white people who were the founders of civilized society. And that's not true. I don't know, Professor Shaw, right? Like the episode we did about the empires in Africa, right?
Yeah.
You know, that like for a long time, black people have been able to, separately of white people, have huge, tremendous positive impact on the world and to lead themselves. And yeah, I think of course black and white and the people of all colors have invented and contributed positive things. But the problem is when history teaches us only half of that story and intentionally hides the other half of the story, which is why on the podcast today, y'all are going to talk a little bit too about, you know, like Black Wall Street as an example of what black people have done with power, right? When they have it, when they're able to access it. And it's pretty incredible, you know, that, you know, freed black people were able to create an entire town, an entire city that had better plumbing, more wealth, stronger businesses than a lot of the white parts of the community that had been free for hundreds of years before them, right? So that's pretty amazing. So I don't know if you want to get into this video about, you know, I know we're trying to stay in the positive. I wish that, so yeah, we could play that actually maybe as an example of you know, some, black people were able to do when they actually had the basic necessities for freedom, which is the right to vote and access to land, owning land.
Okay.
And everything that was built from that.
So Professor Phoebe, you want to introduce us to this next video?
I can do that. Sure. So this is, so this video is kind of related to voting still, right? Because the first video we watched was, you know, kind of gave a teaser. It was like, wow, we had a lot of progress and a bunch of people, you know, a lot of black people who were elected to office. But then he speaks about how that sort of went away by the 1900s. And this video is a specific case study in that. It's a specific example of how that happened all across the country. So this is a video about what happened in Wilmington, Delaware. It talks, again, about the positives, about all the power and influence that black people had in that community. But then it also tells the other side of what happened in response to that when white people felt threatened by sharing power. So if y'all want to get into it and share what you learned from it, we can do that.
If you went to the library in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was one thing you weren't allowed to research.
We were refused. We were rejected by the librarian.
When I asked about or inquired about 1898, they wanted to know why.
I was told that, yes, they had something, but they kept it under lock and key.
The story of Wilmington in 1898 still isn't widely known.
What happened here on what's now just this empty patch of grass would radically change racial politics in North Carolina.
This is the story of an American election, but also of something we don't usually find in American history. The violent overthrow of a democratically elected government. In the late 1800s, Wilmington, North Carolina was the state's largest city. It had a majority black population, and historians today describe it as a rarity in the post-Civil War American South.
Wilmington, prior to November 1898, was what the New South could be at the cusp of the 20th century.
There was an unusual degree of black prosperity.
In Wilmington, there were successful black entrepreneurs, doctors, teachers, but also black elected officials. And for a time, that was true throughout the state. Take a look at the politicians on this poster of the 1889 North Carolina House of Representatives. Here at the bottom are black Republican representatives, some from Wilmington. North Carolina also sent four black Republicans to the U.S. Congress between 1875 and 1899. The Democratic and Republican parties of 1898 in many ways occupied opposite parts of the political spectrum than they do today.
Most African Americans were voting for the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party was white voters almost exclusively. White supremacy was the central focus of the platform for the Democratic Party.
Republicans in North Carolina were successful in part because of a third party called the Populist Party, made up of mostly white farmers fed up with the tough economic times. North Carolina populists joined up with Republicans to form what they called the Fusion Party. And in the elections of 1894 and 1896, the Fusion Party defeated the Democrats in sweeping victories statewide. That meant North Carolina now had a government that shared power between black and white politicians, including a newly elected Republican governor. Together, they moved towards reforms that would favor black Americans and working class whites.
This was something that the Democratic Party folks were simply not going to accept.
A multiracial government wasn't just a disappointment for Democrats. It was more like a humiliation. They needed a plan to take back control of the state in the next election. So party leaders like Furnifold Simmons, future U.S. Senator, Charles Aycock, future North Carolina governor, and this man, Alfred Moore Waddell, came up with one. To beat the Fusion Party by luring white populist voters away from their alliance with black voters. Wilmington, with a large black population and a local fusion government in power, would be a focus of their campaign. The State Democratic Party Handbook for 1898 laid out their goal: consolidate the white vote by stoking white anger and resentment. It said, "This is a white man's country, and white men must control and govern it."
All right, we can take a little pause there.
Thank you so much.
Take a little pause. That's a lot. It's a
I'm
lot in this video.
Today. Oh my god.
Okay. So, Phoebe, I'm gonna ask you first. What did you think about this video? This yeah.
It's funny, I was gonna ask you something first, so I'll say my thing and then kick it back to you. So again, you know, it's so devastating, right? And one of the things that stood out to me in this part is a lot of times these conversations sort of are like black versus white, right? But the reality is that a lot of black and white people have come together with solidarity to have power together. So the fact that there was that fusion party, right, which was like white farmers who had similar interests to free black people, right? They wanted more fairness, more equity, more representative politics. Like, they came together with black people to create a party and to have power together. And then white supremacists tried to break up that allegiance, right? And that's happened a lot. It's not always just white versus black. A lot of times it's white supremacists versus black and white people who have come together to support something that they like a vision and a dream that they have for the country. So I don't know, Lincoln, if that like professor, what's your name today?
I'm muted. I apologize.
Sorry, I got muted.
That's okay. I was just trying to I remember what our professor's name was for but anyway, my
Professor
question
Sean,
back was
or...
yeah, like, you know, I heard you earlier saying, like, well, white people have done things too. So, you know, the fact that there was that connection together, right, feels important. But, and I don't know, I'll kick it back to y'all, right? Like, I guess, are you surprised by how much power people were actually able to have up to that point? And are you surprised that there was pushback?
I mean, I'm not surprised in how much power they were able to have. I just feel as though it wasn't... they certainly shouldn't have been able to have that much power. Because, like, that's never a good thing to have. Like, and plus, like, I feel like they definitely abused their power, obviously. But I feel like... the power should have been more evenly distributed. And there should have been, like, certain rules to having that much power instead of just being able to do, like, what they did. Like,
So. Yeah, and we haven't even fully gotten into what they did, right? Like, we're just starting to get into that in the video. Professor William, you're going to say something?
Yeah, so I kind of, like, was going to ask, Professor HBK a question. So, do you think, like, it could have been possible for them to evenly distribute the power amongst, you know, both sides?
Oh, if they hadn't had such a dispute with black and white, then duh, yeah. Like now.
Yeah.
If they're able to do it now, why couldn't they do it 100, 200 years ago?
Makes sense.
True.
And they did, right? I think that's the positive piece of this, is they did it, right? The fusion party that they just talked about that, you know, made the white supremacists so angry was black and white people coming together to share power, right? And to make things better for everybody. So, all right. Well, with that, we can continue. And this is an important piece because it talks about some of the specific tactics that were used to break that allegiance down, right? And to give white supremacists power back.
Okay, well, we're going to get back into the video. So, yeah.
North Carolina's biggest newspapers was a Democratic Party mouthpiece. It ran racist political cartoons throughout 1898.
Not everybody was literate in 1898, but to see a political cartoon of the type that ran, you may not be able to read it, but you know exactly what it means.
Many of the cartoons were centered on the threat of Negro rule, even though the fusion government was mostly white. They also played up another fear.
Black men threatening white women became a theme. White men need to do all that they can to protect white womanhood.
This was all part of North Carolina Democratic strategy, but it echoed the national racist rhetoric of the time. In one speech that Democrats printed in a Wilmington paper, a prominent Georgia writer named Rebecca Felton said,
"If it takes lynching a black man a day to protect white womanhood, I say lynch."
Her speech prompted a Wilmington black man named Alex Manley, owner of the Black Run Daily Record newspaper, to respond with a column. He made a simple observation that, at the time, was shocking.
That white women who had liaisons with black men did so voluntarily and enthusiastically.
Manley wrote, "Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many were sufficiently attractive for white girls to fall in love with them."
Manley pretty much said, in a nutshell, sometimes white women choose to be with black men.
Manley's editorial became another tool for Democrats. Newspapers reprinted it, called it a horrid slander, and ran comments about it on a daily basis. It was just a few months before the election, and white voters were angry.
By the time the election rolls around on November 8th, black voters, Republican voters, had been thoroughly intimidated here.
By all accounts, the elections of 1898 were a sham. The Democratic Party had a paramilitary group called the Red Shirts. They attacked and blocked black residents from voting. At a rally just before the election, Alfred Moore Waddell provoked the crowds. He said, "Negro office holding ought at once and forever be brought to an end, even if we have to choke the current of the Cape Fear River with carcasses." The votes were counted, and the Democrats won.
Democratic candidates won every seat they had a candidate up for election in.
But some local fusionist politicians remained in power, because their seats hadn't been up for re-election, like the white Republican mayor and the Board of Aldermen. And of course, the election did nothing to undo the economic power black folks held in the city. The Democrats had won the election, but their goal of total white supremacist control remained out of reach.
And so they engineered what was essentially a coup d'etat.
The day after the election, at a gathering for white men in Wilmington, the Democrats unveiled a document called the White Declaration of Independence. It contained an ultimatum. Cynthia Brown, whose descendants were in Wilmington back in 1898, is a historian at her church, where there's a preserved copy of the declaration from the next day's newspaper.
"We will no longer be ruled and will never again be ruled by men of African origin.
they would strip black men of voting rights. They would give white men a large part of the employment heretofore given to black men. And as for Alex Manley, we demand that he leave this city forever within 24 hours. The next morning, hundreds of white men marched to the offices of the Daily Record. Manley was gone. He had fled to save his own life. They set the Daily Record building on fire. This is where it once stood.
Once the white leadership destroyed Alex Manley's printing press, they destroyed one way in which the African American community in Wilmington could organize itself and keep itself informed.
At City Hall, the mayor and Board of Aldermen were forced out.
There's 200 armed men in City Hall at the time. They didn't do it of their own free will. And as they resigned, a new member selected by the Democratic Party was voted into office.
Waddell, who once threatened to fill the Cape Fear River with black bodies, was the new mayor of Wilmington. Meanwhile, the mob had grown to about 2,000 men, and the violence spilled into the streets. In these photos, X's mark where the first black residents were killed.
The stories are that they were dumped into the river, and there are varying stories about how many people were killed.
I see 40 to 60 clearly as fatalities as a result of the violence, but I think it was higher.
Many black residents hid for days in the swamps and the wooded cemeteries in the city, including Cynthia's great-grandmother. And thousands of other residents fled Wilmington, never to return. Shortly afterward, Democrats printed booklets celebrating a glorious victory, and in the newspapers depicted black residents as the instigators.
This image is a gross misrepresentation of what actually happened during 1898. You know, what you see is African-American men with guns, not white men with machine guns.
The city never regained its black majority population. Jim Crow laws, like literacy tests and poll taxes that prevented black people from voting, were immediately enacted, and Wilmington's spirit of black opportunity was crushed. Black political representation in the state was over. It would be 90 years until North Carolina elected its next black Congress member.
Wilmington did a really great job of covering up a very dark past for a very long time.
Over the years, the textbooks on North Carolina's history have struggled to accurately describe what happened in 1898. This one from 1933 says the situation was unfortunate for both races. And this one from 1978 doesn't have that much more detail. But they both praise Charles Aycock, a politician who helped perpetrate the riot. They say he had a keen mind and a kind heart, and that, in fact, he was one of the best friends that the colored people had in the state.
Poor gut health.
Low.
Yo, yo, yo.
Hola.
So what's good? What's good? DJ Phoebs? DJ Phoebs?
Nah, DJ,
oh, Professor Phoebs.
Yeah,
bad.
Professor
Phoebs. Professor Phoebs, my bad. Wrong setting. I'm thinking about the radio.
We feel as though, since you are a guest, you should be talking. So,
that was pretty loud.
It was? My bad. I didn't mean to ear rape you guys.
No, it's okay.
So, what do you...
Economic times. North Carolina populists joined up with Republicans to form what they called the Fusion Party.
Oh, okay. So, in terms of that video, how do you feel as though, like, in terms of their power? Like, remember you were asking before, and I was talking about how, I forgot what I was going to say. Dang, I forget. Literally forgot my question. Hold on. Come back to me, bro.
Okay. Well, let me kick it back to y'all.
Okay.
I mean, first off, right, part of why we're doing this podcast, right, is because there's a lot about history that's not really taught.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I... Like, the fact that, like, in the beginning they were saying, like, go to the local library and try to find this information. They literally had it locked away.
They did?
And then the textbooks, yeah, that's what they're saying, that they had, like, locked it away, that they wouldn't give anyone access to any of those records. Like, no one was allowed to even know that this happened, right? So I think it's really important when we get taught history that we are skeptical, right? Because a lot of times, who writes history? Like the people in power, right?
Yeah, like governors and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's the people in power. So if white supremacists took back their power and then they were the ones writing the history books, then of course they're going to paint a different picture than what was real. And that's what they did. So I think it's really great that y'all are being critical learners and like actually getting into stuff that isn't always taught. And then in terms of power, right? Like there's two types of power. There's the power that we talked about in the beginning, which was black people showing up to vote in elected officials through democracy, right? The American way. And teaming up with other people to do that. And that's the kind of power we want people to have in this country. And then for those, you know, white supremacists who were mad about that, they used a different kind of power, which is violence, right? Violence and lying to the public about it, just feeding all these racist stories. So I don't know, did you catch, like, what were some of the things that you heard in the video about how they were actually able to overthrow a democratically elected government?
That question was very diverse.
What did you take away of, like, what were the ways in which they were able to overthrow what had been a diverse government in North Carolina?
Well, that's okay. We can go back and see right now. Professor Shaw, run it back for us.
He made a simple observation that at the time was shocking.
That white women who had liaisons with black men did so voluntarily and enthusiastically.
Manley wrote, "Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many were sufficiently attractive for white girls to fall in love with them."
Manley pretty much said, in a nutshell, sometimes white women choose to be with black men.
Manley's editorial became another tool for Democrats. Newspapers reprinted it, called it a horrid slander, and ran comments about it on a daily basis. It was just a few months before the election, and white voters were angry.
By the time the election rolls around on November 8th, black voters, Republican voters, had been thoroughly intimidated here.
By all accounts, the elections of 1898 were a sham. The Democratic Party had a paramilitary group called the Red Shirts. They attacked and blocked black residents from voting. At a rally just before the election, Alfred Moore Waddell provoked the crowds. He said, "Negro office holding ought at once and forever be brought to an end, even if we have to choke the current of the Cape Fear River with carcasses." The votes were counted, and the Democrats won.
Democratic candidates won every seat they had a candidate up for election in.
But some local fusionist politicians remained in power because their seats hadn't been up for re-election, like the white Republican mayor and the Board of Aldermen. And of course, the election didn't.
Okay. So, good
question, okay. DJ Shaw.
So,
and Professor Shaw.
What they did is they all voted. Like, okay, so all the black people, they voted for the table or whatever she said. It was like the table, right? So that way, all their votes had to be counted. Professor Phoebe. Your question.
Yeah, so what happened in this election specifically, right, when all the white Democrats were able to win for the first time, was it a fair election?
No.
Why not?
Because
it's kind of like the other votes just didn't really count.
Well, no. Voting. Wasn't it a fair election?
Yeah, why wasn't it fair?
Yeah, why wasn't it fair?
There's people influencing votes that weren't really, well, like people were getting scared or forced into voting for somebody who they didn't want to,
Right. There was intimidation, right? Either keeping black voters from voting at all, right? The Democrats had a private armed military group that was set up all through the city on election day with guns to intimidate anybody who wanted to go out and vote. So this wasn't a fair election at all, right? Because the people weren't able, it didn't represent all the people's votes. A bunch of people were forced to not vote. And then on top of that, right, I think they talked a little bit about how much slander, like how much there was racist stories being told to try to turn white people away from voting for, you know, getting people to turn and vote for the white supremacist party, right? And so there was a really big focus on, you know, trying to describe black people as dangerous, as not as being brutes, right, as not being capable of being in government. So they had this whole force of keeping people from voting, trying to slander the black people who were in power, and then by the end of it, for the people who were left still in power, who were black or white, who were not with the white supremacists, they literally marched with their guns to the Capitol building and said, either leave or die, and they left. And that is how Wilmington, North Carolina became an all-white government until, did you see, it was 1992 until they actually were able to send one black woman back to Congress. They had four already back when this started, right? So the damage of this, I think that's the other thing that people forget in our history. And they're like, why are black people complaining about things now? Like, it's so much better than it used to be. But actually, right now, the politics in North Carolina are worse than they were before this happened for black people, right? Like, black people did actually achieve something, and then that was taken away, and the impact of that lasted for 100 years.
100 years?
100 years, 1992, right? That's how long it took to even start to come back around to having black people elected into office the same way that it used to be.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Also, did you catch that they burned down the black-owned newspaper?
Mm-hmm. Well, no.
Right?
No.
Yeah, so that was another tactic, right? Is they actually went... So black newspapers were a huge, huge accomplishment during Reconstruction. There were a lot of people who founded black newspapers as a way to tell the news from their perspective, but also as a way to help get black people to the polls, to educate them about what was going on, who was running for office, all these issues, right? And so that's a place of really important power that white people also targeted, right? They burned down the black-owned newspaper.
Oh. Yeah.
All right. Well, I know that we're, you know, starting to get towards the end of our time a little bit here, and I think maybe we can end with that last video that we had queued up, because instead of leaving us kind of in this negative place,
yeah,
I think it's just really important for people to know what is possible and what has been possible and what's been accomplished when black people have had access to land and to political power.
Okay.
So this is a video that talks about what was built around the same time period that we were just in, right? This is like the late 1800s and the early 1900s now, right? That is Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, a place where, and it talks about how a black man who bought 40 acres was able to use that power and build a whole black community that was incredibly, incredibly powerful. And supported all the people in ways, honestly, that are even more radical than today's society. So yeah, you want to close out on kind of that note, and it speaks to why these issues are so important and why political, gotcha, right? Why political power is so important.
Today, we're going to find out. The stories of Greenwood's prosperity became legend in the black community. And in fact, in the whole world. The creation of the powerful black community known as Black Wall Street was intentional. In 1906, O.W. Gurley, a wealthy African-American from Arkansas, moved to Tulsa and purchased over 40 acres of land that he made sure was only sold to other African-Americans. The young entrepreneur had just resigned from a presidential appointment under President Grover Cleveland in order to strike out on his own. Mr. Gurley became a multimillionaire, and he was the owner of several businesses, including his prized possession, which was a hotel. He also provided an opportunity for those who migrated
from the harsh oppression of Mississippi. Another important visionary who contributed to the success of Black Wall Street was Mr. J.B. Stratford. J.B. Stratford had graduated from Indiana University with a law degree and had moved to Greenwood to purchase various land vacancies in the area. After buying these vacant spaces, he would then sell them to African-American residents for redevelopment so that these empty spaces could be transformed into residential houses and profitable businesses. By 1921, Mr. Stratford had been considered one of the wealthiest in the country, as he owned numerous properties in Greenwood and even had his hotel named after him, the Stratford Hotel. O.W. was a subscriber to the philosophies of Booker T. Washington, while J.B. was a follower of the more radical W.E.B. Du Bois. Nonetheless, their differences aside, the two men began to develop an all-black district in the unincorporated stretch of land north of Tulsa's train station. O.W. and J.B. both became rich as the oil industry boomed in Tulsa and hundreds of African Americans immigrated to Greenwood. The 40 acres that were purchased resulted in a thriving community that populated a 35 square block district. There were over 600 businesses, and on Black Wall Street were attorneys, real estate agents, dentists, pilots, architects, musicians and singers, entrepreneurs, doctors, pharmacists, dry cleaners, plumbers, barbers, hairdressers, professors and teachers, nurses, bankers, newspaper editors, among many other professions who offered their services in the neighborhood. A dollar circulated 36 to 100 times, and it remained in the Greenwood District almost a year before leaving. To this day, no other community has been able to duplicate that type of circulation. There are communities today, however, where the dollar stays in about 30 days and 45 days, but no other community, as has been said, has ever been able to match that type of circulation. Although it wasn't the only one, there were prominent black business districts in Durham, North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, and Rosewood, Florida. The people of Greenwood achieved a level of black economic success and self-determination that had never existed before in the United States. Less than 60 years removed from slavery, to put that in perspective. Despite racial discrimination and Jim Crow segregation, the Greenwood District offered proof that black entrepreneurs were capable of creating abundant wealth. When left alone, our ancestors thrived. And one such example is this. In the entire state of Oklahoma, there were only two airports. Yet six black families owned their own private planes in the District of Black Wall Street. Wow, imagine that. Folks, think about that for a second. There were two airports in the entire state of Oklahoma, yet six families owned private planes. What an accomplishment. Many of the homes had indoor plumbing before those in the white area did. Booker T. Washington actually coined it Negro Wall Street. It was also known at that time as Little Africa. What made Black Wall Street truly special is that it was a place an ordinary person can go, such as a sharecropper, and have a respectable life, find decent paying work, and hope for a better life for his or her children. With oil men relocating to Tulsa, the resulting high demand for domestics enabled blacks to attain unheard of wages. Maids earned $20 to $25 a week, chauffeurs earned $15, gardeners earned $20, janitors, shoe shiners, and porters earned around $10. Domestics made up almost two-thirds of Greenwood's population, the remainder being professionals and business owners, whom the maids and chauffeurs hoped their children could imitate. As you can see, Black Wall Street was very well run. Keep in mind, the domestics spoken of were actually blacks working for other blacks. The average income of black families in the area exceeded what the minimum wage is today. These were people who were actually living in the lap of luxury. Black Wall Street was its own city. It was a booming self-contained community, and many of the residents lived in luxury. Greenwood Avenue had been lined with hotels, restaurants, furriers,
and even an early taxi service using a Ford Model T. For that time, that would be like driving a modern-day Bentley. This is actually a picture of the Stratford Hotel, owned by Mr. J.B. Stratford. And he is a great example of excellence and abundance in the early 1900s. As stated earlier, he was a multi-millionaire. In addition to Mr. Stratford and Mr. Gurley, the district's most successful entrepreneurs reinvested in the community, building parks, schools, churches, theaters, banks, and they had access to many luxuries that whites in the same city did not. As a matter of fact, white people routinely borrowed money from black banks, and this was even done during the Great Depression. Here's a picture of bank owners and employees taking a picture in front of one of the black-owned banks. Here's the picture of one of the theaters that line the Greenwood District. During that time, while showing the silent movies, they would have a live piano player playing alongside the movie, which was the custom of the day. So you see, Black Wall Street had all of the modern day conveniences and luxuries. They were a community that really wanted for nothing. The schools were superior to those of the white areas. When the average student went to school on Black Wall Street, he wore a suit and tie because of the morals and respect they were taught at a young age. Black Wall Street contained a business college. As a matter of fact, the children of Greenwood's professionals attended Columbia Law School, Oberlin College, Hampton University, the Tuskegee Institute, Spelman College, and Atlanta University. Black Wall Street was a dream in progress and a symbol of black success. Just how wealthy was Black Wall Street? The truth is, we'll really never know. But based on the facts, we can confidently say that today's worth will be well into the billions. And just think, that was a self-contained community that was just developing. There is no telling where it would be today. Although Greenwood, Tulsa, Oklahoma, may be a distant memory, fortunately for us, we can still keep the Black Wall Street spirit alive today. With the Black Wall Street app, we now have access to thousands of black-owned businesses in the palm of your hand, desktop, or tablet. The legacy still lives on today.
Hello, hello, hello. Professor Phoebe.
Professor Shaw.
Are we good to end?
Oh, I just want to hear real quick. What do y'all, did y'all know about Black Wall Street?
Not at all.
Like, I anything that stood out to you?
And, huh?
Yeah.
Talked about it, but like,
I don't think I remembered it.
I didn't write it down.
Yeah, I mean, just some of the things that stood out, right, was the ability to create community wealth. One of the things that stood out to me was that for everyone who worked in that community, they were making wages that are higher than today's minimum wage, right? Like, that's really amazing. And I also think it's really amazing that they had things like indoor plumbing, private airplanes.
They went to black banks.
White people were going to black banks to bail them out, right? That's a part of history that I think gets really erased, right? Because it definitely doesn't feed into the story of white supremacy, right? In this case, you had the black part of town had indoor plumbing first. They had better wages. They had more wealth. They had when banks they that white alone, people had thriving, to depend on. Yeah. Right? That's something that a lot of people don't know about. And
that's something I learned. So. You know,
yeah, what?
That was something I learned, that when they were left alone, they were thriving and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that line's important, right? When left alone, had no problem thriving, right? And that was true.
Definitely.
In North Carolina too, right? And so, and I think what's really important to maybe take away from this too is that, you know, that white people could go to the black banks, right? Like, there wasn't reverse racism. Like, yeah, black people had created their own community in town, but it didn't negatively affect white people, right? Like, it was something to be inspiring. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, there's this feeling that it's a competition, and it's not, right? If we could all just let each other be free to build the lives that we want and to support each other, some really wonderful things can happen. And I also think, you know, black people understood how important it was to support each other, because the government never had their back, right? So they had to build it for themselves, but they were very, very successful in doing that. So it's a pretty powerful story about what can happen when black people have the rights and the freedoms that they were promised all the way back, right? And we started in 1865, but in reality, we're still fighting for today.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Well, any final thoughts, professors, before we sign off?
I don't have any.
None. Nah, not really. I think we good. Thank you, Phoebes, though, for dropping in with that good conversation.
Right. Yeah.
You brought a lot to the table, and I appreciate that. Also, I feel as though next week, or next, when do we do it? Every other 2 weeks?
Every Saturday.
Every other Saturday? All right. So I feel like the next Saturday, we're going to bring you a little something on, I feel like we kind of didn't really talk about the positives like we planned on. So I feel like next time we should actually like focus on the positives.
Okay. I'm down for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, facts. But other than that,
we'll get into it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to end this stream, and then I'm going to hang up, and we're going to catch you.
Just, and I'll, yeah. Go ahead, end the stream.
Okay.